resistance can feel like freedom.
The dead giveaway for the resistance stack is that the enemy still sets the agenda. The synthetic stack does not necessarily have to defeat us. All it needs to do is keep us permanently occupied in resisting it.
Okay, so today I want to introduce a term that I think is extremely important. I've touched on it before in my previous episode on the sovereign and synthetic stack. I've touched on it in some Noster posts, things like this. What I'm talking about is the resistance stack, this term that I use alongside the sovereign stack or the synthetic stack. I've used the term mimicry stack before, and I'm going to stop using this term just to avoid having two names for the same thing. Although I still think that mimicry is useful. It gets at something important because the resistance stack mimics sovereignty. It looks like freedom. And so that's actually part of what makes the resistance stack so dangerous. And so what I want to do, starting with this episode, is make a short series explaining this whole stacks framework as I understand it more in depth, as I've learned more about it since first having talked about it in my previous episode. But I'm deliberately starting with the resistance stack, and there's a good reason for that, which is I think that the synthetic stack is definitely the most nefarious. But for people like us who are Bitcoiners, libertarians, cypherpunks, I think the resistance stack might actually be more dangerous to us because it's the hardest one to see. With the synthetic stack, once you start seeing it, it's really hard to unsee. It's the fiat system. It's the state, KYC, banks, government ID, custodians, surveillance, the digital control grid, if you will, the matrix, if you want to call it that. It's the system. And once you see that system, it becomes much easier to recognize. And I'll explain more of that properly in the synthetic stack episode. But what I'm going with this is that the resistance stack is actually much harder to see because the resistance stack can look almost exactly like the sovereign stack, right? This is why I used the term mimicry before, because it can sound anti-system. The resistance stack can talk about freedom. Resistance stack tools might be decentralized. They might use encryption. They might attack the fiat system. Some of the resistance stack tools might contain really good technology. There are some things that are just in the resistance stack that are obviously anti-synthetic stack. But the point is of the resistance stack is that it's not the sovereign stack. It can still stop one layer short of sovereignty. And so this is precisely the problem that I want to explore here. And so the main overarching question guiding this episode is this idea of what happens to sovereign freedom maximalist energy before it becomes sovereign infrastructure. Because once that energy appears, what I've discovered is that there are basically two directions that it can go, right? So what happens to sovereign freedom maximalist energy before it becomes sovereign infrastructure? The one route it can go is into construction of the sovereign infrastructure. Freedom maximalist energy becomes sovereign infrastructure. That's one possible route. I think there's a second route. This is what I'm trying to argue here, is that it can become construction of sovereign infrastructure, or it can get trapped, captured, intercepted, and ultimately routed back toward the synthetic stack. And so that second possibility is what I want to talk about today. This is what I mean by the resistance stack. It's this sovereign freedom maximalist energy getting rerouted, trapped, captured back into the synthetic stack. And so before I get there, just very briefly, I want to touch on the three stacks. And again, these are not full definitions, but for now, the synthetic stack is the incumbent default system. I think it might be easier to use existing terms and language such as the digital control grid or the matrix or the fiat system or the state kind of corporate system. I think there are plenty of other terms. I would tend to argue that these terms alone don't do it justice, which is why I use the term synthetic stack. But it's pretty much the structure where money, identity, communication, data, all these different things, they ultimately depend on institutions above you that can define the rules. They can grant you access or revoke your access. They can change the terms and they can surveil you. So that's the synthetic stack in a nutshell. The sovereign stack is the alternative to that. And again, much more on this later, but essentially the sovereign stack, using existing language, is like the anarcho-capitalist, Bitcoin maximalist, Noster, FOSS, cypherpunk maximalist system. Systems where the individual can actually own, verify, transact, communicate, exit without some permanent ruler or gatekeeper sitting at the root of everything. The permissionless system, the decentralized system. So those two stacks are very easy to see, to understand. Maybe they're easier to see and understand. They're diametrically opposed. But what we have is this weird middle layer, which is the resistance stack. Right? The synthetic stack, it looks like the cage. The sovereign stack clearly looks like the attempt to actually construct exit from the cage. But the resistance stack, it fights the cage. It fights the cage, but it never fully leaves its gravitational field. And this is why it is so hard to recognize. Because resistance can feel like freedom. So I want to talk about this, why Bitcoin makes this question so urgent. I just published an essay called Bitcoin Made Sovereign Civilization Possible. And the question I was really trying to answer in that essay was, why does Bitcoin matter so much? But the argument I ended up making was basically this idea that freedom movements throughout history repeatedly ran into a continuity problem. And what I mean by that is you could resist the state, you could move away, you could build a homestead, a private community, you could trade privately, you could do all kinds of things to gain freedom from the ruling order. But eventually, and this is what I talk about in the essay, is that once economic coordination became large enough or complex enough, the freedom movement was always rerouted back into the fiat system. The ruling monetary system always came back into the picture whenever coordination became large enough. Your savings, your business reserves, your banking, your settlement for trade, your taxes. If you wanted to save over time, more often than not, it always routed you back into the fiat system. And so eventually the money, it pulled the attempted exit from the shit system back onto the foundation it was trying to escape. And my argument is that Bitcoin fundamentally changed that. That for the first time ever, at global digital scale, people became able to hold, validate, settle, transmit monetary property without some permanent monetary king writing the ledger, deciding what counts, what doesn't count. And I think that means something enormous, right? I talk about this in the essay, that freedom can now preserve its own sacrifice. And when I say sacrifice, I mean this very simply, that you work, you produce something, you don't consume everything that you earn, you save some of it. That's your sacrifice carried forward through time. And Bitcoin gives that sacrifice somewhere to live outside of the discretionary fiat issuance. So one person can earn Bitcoin, they can save it, they can invest it into someone building something. That person can pay a merchant, that merchant can pay somebody else. Families can save across generations. Capital can now stay within the network. And so one person's exit from the fiat system can now help capitalize somebody else's construction. And so that is not merely resistance anymore. That is the beginning of construction. And so that is why I think this idea of resistance is so important. After Bitcoin, permanent resistance can become a trap. So this is why Bitcoin makes this question urgent. And now, to be clear, I'm not claiming that nothing sovereign existed before Bitcoin. Obviously, that's false. My point is that Bitcoin gives sovereign, libertarian, freedom maximalist activity a monetary foundation that can potentially accumulate and persist across time without having to place its economic memory back under a king or a state or a central issuer. And so that changes the realm of what is possible. And once construction becomes materially possible, permanent resistance starts looking very different. And so this is where the argument takes the next step. Because once Bitcoin solves the monetary problem, or at least gives us a way to exit that monetary dependency, it creates a new question. What about everything else, right? We solved the money, but what about everything else? What about our identity, our communication, the foundations that we build our businesses upon, how we buy food, how we get healthcare, how we settle disputes, how we educate our kids? And so what I mean by this is that we realize that we fixed the money, but what about everything else, right? The money might be sovereign, while everything else around the money still is not sovereign. You hold the Bitcoin, but you're coordinating through Telegram. You hold the Bitcoin, but your entire digital life still runs through Apple or Google. Your businesses still depend on banks, payment processors, cloud providers, government licenses, and accounts that can be shut off. You hold Bitcoin, but outside of saving it, you don't actually have very many people around you who can produce, trade, or build with you outside the old system. And so this is precisely where I think Bitcoin becomes much bigger than just money. Because once you've experienced actual ownership in one layer of your life, it becomes much easier to recognize where you don't have that freedom. Bitcoin gives us a reference point. It gives us a standard. It basically forces you to start asking the same kinds of questions everywhere else. Like, do you actually own this? Do you actually own your identity? Do you have sovereignty over your healthcare? Who controls the rules? Who am I trusting in this? Can somebody take this away from me, right? Can I operate without this third party? And so I kind of touch upon this in the essay, that this is where the idea of the sovereign stack starts to emerge. I don't think it's because Bitcoin automatically creates the sovereign stack, but I think it reveals that the rest of the sovereign stack still has to be built. We solved, or at least radically changed, the money problem, but what about everything else, right? The rest of civilization. And so this whole thing finally arrives at the problem that I actually want to talk about, which is
that once those other dependencies become visible, there is a fork in the road. And I touched on this really quickly. One path is construction. We take that desire for freedom, that sovereign, libertarian, freedom maximalist energy. We take our time and attention and money, our technical ability, our relationships, our willingness to take risks, and we actually start turning that into real, sovereign, libertarian, freedom maximalist alternatives. New infrastructure, new ways of communicating, trading, coordinating, these ways that do not require the old system. And so that one path, when we're looking at the fork, that one path is the movement towards what I call the sovereign stack. But that's only one path. There's another path. And that path is, instead of replacing all those dependencies, we simply become better at resisting them, better at hiding from them, better at fighting them, better at protecting ourselves from them, better at finding workarounds, better at building countercultures, right? And some of those things are genuinely useful. Some of them are absolutely necessary. But if that's where the process stops, then something really, really, really important has happened. The impulse for sovereignty, the desire for sovereignty and freedom has appeared. We saw the problem. We wanted to exit the shit system. We had the energy that could have gone into building the sovereign system, but somewhere between recognizing the cage, recognizing the capture, the prison, and actually constructing the exit, that energy got redirected. It got trapped in opposition, in resistance. And sometimes, and I think this is the really important part, sometimes that energy, even it not only gets stuck, but it also gets routed right back into the synthetic stack system that it was trying to escape. And so that is the middle layer, right between dependence and actual construction. This is what I mean by the resistance stack. And so here's the definition. And I want to take this slowly because I think this really is like the whole episode right here is the resistance stack is the collection, right? The stack of tools, institutions, ideas, habits, communities, cultures that takes a real desire for freedom and sovereignty and keeps that energy organized around fighting, avoiding, hiding, surviving, or reacting to the existing system instead of turning that energy, that attention into a new system capable of actually standing on its own. And so there are a couple important pieces there, right? First, the sovereign impulse is real. The desire for freedom is real in the resistance stack. The person actually wants freedom. They might understand the problem correctly. They might see the synthetic stack for what it is. They may genuinely be resisting something evil. The technology of the resistance stack might truly work. And so that's what makes this so difficult. That's the first point in that definition. And secondly, is that the energy never completes the transition into construction. It remains organized around the thing that it opposes. I'll try my best to compress it really simply, that the resistance stack is sovereign freedom energy captured before it becomes sovereign infrastructure. So if you remember that fork in the road. So the important thing here is that this is not just about beliefs or intentions. Someone can genuinely believe in freedom, right? They can hate the state, they can hate fiat, they can care deeply about privacy, use Bitcoin encryption, they can even call themselves sovereign or libertarian, and they can still be operating inside the resistance stack. Because remember, the question is about what does this tool or what does this idea actually depend on? Where does it ultimately lead? This is where we have to look at the structure underneath the surface. And this is where the resistance stack gets difficult because the thing that you're using might genuinely make you more free. It might protect you from surveillance. It might help you route around censorship. It might let you hold your money directly, right? It might make you much harder to control. All of that can be real, but there's still another question, right? Did this actually move the underlying part of your life into sovereign infrastructure, or did it simply give you a better way to operate while the deeper system remained underneath you? That's the threshold that we have to start seeing, because the resistance stack, it's not necessarily fake freedom, right? That's almost too easy. But the dangerous version of the resistance stack is that partial freedom feels like completed exit. You might escape one layer. You might actually gain a real advantage. You might actually feel the difference. And because of this, because it works, because you can feel the difference, you stop looking further, right? You stop looking underneath the surface. Meanwhile, the larger structure can still terminate back inside the synthetic stack. And that is how sovereign energy gets stuck halfway. You saw the cage, you moved against it, you might have gained some partial freedom, but instead of that freedom becoming the foundation for the next stage of construction, it settles into a permanent form of resistance. And that is precisely the trap. And so now I want to look at what that trap looks like in practice. So here's kind of the basic pattern. The synthetic stack creates a real problem. You correctly recognize it. That recognition creates energy. You become willing to change, to spend money differently, right? You decide to learn and take risks. You might install new software. All of this is potential sovereign energy. And then something offers resistance. And again, resistance can be extremely useful. You get real improvement, and because that improvement is real, it becomes very easy to mistake the workaround for the destination, right? That's the trap. And so I'm going to give you some examples. And I know this is going to be controversial. I think here, one example is Telegram. Why do human rights dissidents, journalists, Bitcoiners, freedom people, and all kinds of anti-system communities use Telegram? Why? Because it gives them something that they don't get as easily through ordinary mainstream communication channels. It can provide real coordination capability. But what I'm saying is that Telegram is an excellent example of resistance stack communication. You have moved away from ordinary corporate communication culture. You have gained some real capability, but your communication is still fundamentally taking place through somebody else's centrally operated platform. That is resistance. It might be useful resistance, sometimes good resistance, but it is not the same thing as actually having sovereign communication infrastructure. Another one I think is Signal, right? The communication app Signal. And this is a bit harder. And I actually think that's why it's a better example, because Signal gives you genuinely excellent end-to-end encrypted communication, right? That is real. Signal, however, currently still requires a phone number to register an account, even though usernames and phone number privacy features mean that you don't necessarily have to expose that number to the people you're talking to. But still, like what is Signal, right? And from my framework here, I think it's a very strong resistance stack communications tool, albeit with serious sovereign properties. The encryption is real, the protection is real, but it still starts inside an identity and service architecture that has not fully escaped the old system. And that's exactly the kind of thing I'm trying to get people to think about. It's not that Signal is just blatantly bad, but the question here is, what exactly did we escape from and what did we merely make safer? That's the threshold. I think we can talk about the same thing with an iPhone. Right, you can run really good Bitcoin apps or wallets on an iPhone. You can use Nostr, right? Apple makes, you know, pretty solid encrypted communications, right? You can do all kinds of useful things, but you're still operating inside a hardware and software ecosystem where Apple controls everything. And again, I'm not telling you to throw your iPhone away. But what I'm saying is, don't confuse sovereign applications with having sovereign computing, right? Those are different layers. This is why Linux matters so much. This is why Graphene OS matters so much. This is why free and open source software matters so much, because there are attempts to move, just on this example of computing, there are attempts to move the computing layer itself further towards sovereign architecture. And this is going to get slightly more confusing, but even then, and this is important, you can run Linux, Graphene, Nostr, self-custody Bitcoin, and still live almost entirely inside the resistance stack, because sovereign tools alone don't necessarily compose into a sovereign life. They can become an extremely sophisticated defensive shell around the same deeper dependencies. And so that's the thing that we have to watch. There's a lot of nuance here, but I want to talk about another example, which is Nostr. And I think it's a great example because I really like Nostr. It gives us incredibly powerful sovereign primitives. It gives us keys. It gives us signed events, multiple clients, multiple relays, right? These things are amazing. But even inside Nostr, the way we compose those tools matters very much. Take Nostr Wallet Connect, NWC, the NIP 47 specification literally says that custodians may implement the protocol, or the user can run a bridge between NWC and their own wallet or node. And this is just a small example. I understand. It's all Nostr, but it's totally different architectures. One architecture built on top of Nostr can end in a custodian, which is Dedic stack, and the other can end in infrastructure that you actually control, right? So that's the fork, and that's the point. The sovereign label does not magically flow upwards through everything built on top of a sovereign protocol. Just because it's Nostr, just because it's Bitcoin, does not automatically mean that it's sovereign stack. You can rebuild the synthetic stack. You can rebuild these relationships on top of sovereign stack primitives. And this is why architecture matters. Bitcoin itself is sovereign money, but a Bitcoiner can absolutely have a resistance stack strategy. Here's a simple example. You can stack sats, complain about fiat. You can study the collapse of civilization. You can track everything that the government is doing, and you can wait for hyper Bitcoinization. And you can assume that Bitcoin is eventually going to construct the rest of the civilization automatically. And I think this is severe resistance stack thinking. I don't think the problem is stacking sats. The problem is when monetary sovereignty becomes the endpoint instead of the foundation. Bitcoin gives you the capital, but then what? Who builds the rest? Bitcoin is not going to build your sovereign school. Bitcoin is not going to raise your children. Bitcoin, yes, it gives the sovereign civilization an extraordinary monetary foundation, but the civilization still has to be constructed. So there is still, even if you say that, you know, you're a Bitcoiner, you're a Bitcoin maximalist, I still think there is a lot of resistance stack thinking that we have to grow out of. I'm going to give another controversial example. I want to talk about Monero, XMR, because Monero has real sovereign properties. Strong privacy, self-custody, proof-of-work algorithm, permissionless settlement. Its transactions hide the sender, the recipient, the amount of information. It's got really strong privacy technology. So I'm definitely not putting Monero next to some shitcoin. But I think my argument is more specific here, is that I classify Monero's monetary architecture as resistance stack because I think it takes a legitimate sovereign demand that you want private exchange. And what Monero does is it responds to this desire for private exchange. It responds by creating an entire separate monetary jurisdiction organized heavily around resisting surveillance rather than completing private exchange around what I view as the sovereign monetary root, which is Bitcoin. And you may disagree with that, that's fine, But I just think it's an excellent boundary case precisely because Monero is good at what it resists. And that is the key. The resistance stack is not necessarily about shitty technology or shitty ideas. There might be incredible technology, good ideas. It might sometimes beat particular sovereign stack tools at a particular function today. But I just don't think that that automatically makes the larger architecture sovereign. And I think that is exactly why this stack, the resistance stack, is so hard to see. And so I think at this point, there is a problem that is arising here. Everything today still depends on something. So where is this line that we have to draw? If you use one fiat supplier, are you resistance stack? No, I don't think so. If your sovereign libertarian community uses state roads, are you resistance stack? No. If you use Signal while building something else, are you resistance stack? Again, no, I don't think so. I think we can better distinguish. And I think the easiest way to understand it is that some dependencies, some resistance stack dependencies or synthetic stack dependencies are scaffolding. And I think other dependencies are the foundation. Maybe you're building a house, right? The scaffolding is there while you're constructing it, fine. But the finished house is not supposed to remain structurally dependent on the scaffolding forever. So I think that's the same thing here. Maybe your business, your Bitcoin business, right, still has to pay certain suppliers in fiat dollars. That's fine. Clearly, right? Maybe your community uses Signal right now. Maybe some servers are hosted somewhere that, you know, you don't love. But the question is, are you moving away from that dependency, or is that dependency permanently built into the final system? Right? Is this a temporary bridge because the sovereign stack is still incomplete, or is the old system permanently sitting underneath the supposed alternative? And I think this distinction matters because without it, right, we cannot tell the difference between something being constructed and something merely becoming a more sophisticated form of resistance. And so at this point, this is where the idea gets much bigger than just talking about Telegram or Signal or Monero, because ideas can also be resistance stack. Habits, entire identities can be resistance stack. If you know, the goal is to wake everybody up, okay, then what? So then what? We expose what the system is doing, and then what? Like, fight the CBDCs, elect Bitcoin politicians, and hope that fiat is going to collapse. So is that truly the best strategy going forward? I think we can ask a better question. At some point, we have to ask, like, what are we actually building? There's a time to protest. There's a time to expose the shitty system. There's a time to warn people and wake them up, right? There's a time to study the enemy and call out their bullshit. But beating the same dead horse forever, I think, becomes an opportunity cost, because every hour that we spend proving for the thousandth time that centralized institutions behave like centralized institutions, I think, is an hour that could have gone into learning something, into teaching somebody, creating a local trade relationship, building a household, creating schools, clinics, you know, private law infrastructure. And so I think the dead giveaway for the resistance stack is that the enemy still sets the agenda. Whatever the synthetic stack does next determines what you talk about next. It's reaction. They release something, they pass something, they censor something, they propose some bullshit, and you react. They create the clock and you live on it. And so this is what I mean when I say resistance energy, or that sovereign libertarian energy, can get
trapped.
And so now I want to talk about how does this energy get fed back into the synthetic stack? The mechanism of how does resistance feed the synthetic stack? How does the synthetic stack actually, I think in some ways, thrive upon resistance? And I think there are two ways. The first, I think, is more obvious, and that is recapture. You oppose big tech by spending your entire life generating engagement for big tech. You oppose surveillance by using infrastructure that still produces useful data about you. You oppose fiat through a custodial financial fucking product that leaves the banking system sitting between you and the asset, right? You oppose the state while making the state recognition the final goal, right? Your attention, your money, your identity, your legitimacy, your coordination, all of these things route back into the thing that you're resisting. And that is direct recapture. And the other way, so that's method one, that energy gets fed back into the synthetic stack. So it's recapture. The other way is what I call sterilization. Maybe the synthetic stack gets nothing directly, but you have found that you've spent 10 years fighting, researching, arguing, preparing, doom scrolling, right? Switching between resistance tools, waiting for collapse. And at the end of those 10 years, there still isn't a serious alternative system capable of performing the functions everybody remains dependent on. The energy never returned back to the synthetic stack directly, but it also never became construction. And so the synthetic stack retains the territory by default. That's the trap of sterilization. And that's why I think resistance can actually become fuel for synthetic power without anybody secretly controlling anything, right? If the people most capable of building outside the system spend their whole lives reacting to the system, then the system wins something enormous. It just keeps being the center of attention, the center of energy, the center of gravity. And so we ask, where then does this energy need to go? Where should it go? And for me, I think it's a simple answer. It's into construction. This is where the sovereign stack begins. A sovereign individual who can actually own and operate and take responsibility and verify and learn. This is construction. Households capable of preserving and transmitting that sovereignty. Merchants who create actual production and exchange between those individuals and the households, right? Local communities that can coordinate repeatedly. And then I think eventually larger voluntary networks between those communities, federations, citadels. We're talking about trade, communication, law, health, energy, care for people who cannot care for themselves, right? Physical infrastructure, right? And maybe the construction of this thing, this civilization, if you will, maybe it doesn't happen all at once. We might still have to use the old system while we build this sovereign civilization, but the direction is construction. Individuals, households, merchants, local communities, federations, citadels. And I'll explain what I mean by that later in another episode. But the important thing here is that sovereignty has to reproduce. It's not just about survival. Consider this, right? If one extremely competent Bitcoiner can survive anything by himself, but if the system dies when he dies, right, that's not civilization. If a household can transmit knowledge and capital to its children, now we're talking about reproduction. We're moving beyond survival, right? If merchants can create repeated exchange, now we're talking about, you know, compounding. If local institutions can survive founders, this is what it means to like build something, right? This is where the sovereign energy has to go, into construction. And so how do you know which side of the line you're on? Right. So I'm going to give you a few questions. The first question is, does this actually move a human function out of synthetic settlement, or does it just protect me while I remain inside it? Second, where does this ultimately settle? When you ask that question about your money, your identity, your communication, your coordination, your data, who or what still sits at the bottom of the stack? Third, does this system keep the adversary as its permanent center? Does the whole thing only make sense because I'm fighting them? Or does it have a positive function that can stand on its own? Fourth, is the energy that I put into this becoming an actual sovereign circuit, like a closed loop that can accumulate and reproduce? Or is this energy leaking back into the synthetic stack through identity, permission, fiat, attention, custody, or endless reaction? And then the last question is, if we keep doing exactly this for 20 years, what do we end up with? Do we end up with a sovereign civilization, or do we end up with a much more sophisticated resistance movement? And I think that is the best last question. And so, obviously, this concept has to apply to itself. If I spend the next 10 years talking about the resistance stack and everybody starts using the term and we create memes and we call each other resistance stack, you know, and people put SovStack in their bios and Bitcoiners and Monero people fight about it, all while nobody builds anything, then I think the resistance stack has captured the resistance stack. I don't think we ought to make the concept smaller. That's why I'm putting out this episode. But I do think it's a reason to actually think about all of this. And so that is why I'm starting this series with the resistance stack. The synthetic stack may be the more openly coercive system, but resistance is the layer that I think can fool the people who already understand the problem. And I think that's what makes it so dangerous. Bitcoin changed the conditions forever. It gave the freedom, the ability to preserve capital outside the ruling monetary foundation. It made construction possible in a way that did not exist before at this scale. So seeing the cage, seeing the prison is no longer enough. Fighting the cage is no longer enough. Hiding the cage from the cage is no longer enough. And there are times when those things are necessary, but the whole argument here is that they cannot be the final horizon, the end goal, right? The sovereign's the task of the sovereign freedom maximalist libertarian movement or project or whatever is to take all of that energy, all of the anger, all of the knowledge, the technical skill, the courage, all of the capital relationships, the desire to exit, and turn it into systems that can actually live. Systems that can accumulate and reproduce and thrive and survive beyond the people who started them, right? Because the synthetic stack does not necessarily have to defeat us. All it needs to do is keep us permanently occupied in resisting it. And I don't think that's good enough anymore. Bitcoin made construction possible. Now we have to construct. So I'll leave you with this. The resistance fights the cage. Sovereignty constructs the exit. The resistance stack is what happens when we stop one layer too early. So with that said, only signal survives, the rest is noise. I'll see you in the next one. Thanks a lot.